Jewish History, the years 3413 to 3829, part 2.
We'll just wait a minute or two extra until like 7:32 to make sure, and then we'll begin. Okay, a few weeks ago, the official title of tonight's class is Jewish History Continues, and we were dealing before Hanukkah with the period of time of the first Beis HaMikdash, and I was going to continue and go through Hanukkah as well. I'm going to pick up from there, even though we had a few weeks off in between and somebody else spoke. We're not actually even going to get to Hanukkah itself tonight. So this is part two, and we'll see how many more parts we have to keep adding until we get there. And then, like I promised, we will back up to where we were up to when we started from the beginning of time, and we're up to the times of Noach, and we'll continue from there, and we'll catch up eventually. The last things we spoke about was the second Beis HaMikdash, the time of the prophets, the time of Ezra. I'm not going to go through it in detail again tonight. I'm just going to say that Ezra passed away and died on the 9th of Teves. The other prophets that were there then were Haggai and Zechariah. They too had also died by the period of time that we're beginning tonight. Nehemiah as well had to return to Bava, where he also passed away. And this marks the end of the years of the prophets. That's where we ended in the last class that we had together. Just so that you know, Chazal tells us that even though the years of the prophets have ended, the Gemara tells us that prophecy still exists. But prophecy exists today in two places: fools and children. That's where you find prophecy. Something to think about. I'm not going to go into a shiur tonight on fools and children. But that's what Gemara says, that prophecy still exists. Ezra and the members of the Great Assembly had already published all 24 books of the Torah. That includes the 5 books of the Chumash and all the 19 books of the Ksuvim, the Tanakh, and everything that went with it. In its accurate and original holy writing, that's the way Ezra was a sofa, we'll get to that in a second. He clarified every single letter. He incorporated the prophets as well, and he put it all together. And remember, like I just said, Ezra was called Ezra HaSofer. He was a scribe, he was a sofer. He was a master of the Hebrew language and the Hebrew letters. And as we've seen in the past, his implementations of knowledge of the Hebrew letters he applied to both the building of the Beis HaMikdash as well as to the writings of the Torah. In other words, originally we had, by the Mishkan even, in the early on, we had Bezalel, who was the one who put the Mishkan together. Bezalel was also a scribe. The letters of the Aleph Beis themselves mean a lot more than just the letters itself. They have a numeric value. They have a kedusha. When you put certain letters together, you're not allowed to separate them. If you put a yud and a hey and a rav and a hey, since it ends up spelling Hashem's name in the letters of the Hebrew letters, you can't separate them. You can't cut them. The letters themselves have certain powers. And when the Torah says, for example, Bereshis bara Elokim, in the beginning Hashem created Es Hashemayim, the heavens, but really Es Hashemayim means the heavens. You could have said Bereshis bara Elokim Hashemayim v'haaretz. God created the earth, the heavens, and the earth. But it doesn't say that. It says Es Hashemayim v'es haaretz. That word Es, which means the, is made up of two letters, an aleph and a tav, which is the first letter of the alphabet and the last letter of the alphabet. And Chazal teaches us that that means that Hashem used the letters of the aleph beis in order to be able to create the world. The letters of the aleph beis themselves have certain powers and certain kochos. Tonight's not an aleph beis year, but I'm just sharing with you why it was necessary that a person who was knowledgeable as a scribe, such as Ezra, was the one who was involved in building and imbuing the Beis HaMikdash with the power and the Kedusha that it had. And now, when it came time for the Beis HaMikdash to be built, like I just said, Ezra HaSofer had to come along, and he was the one who took all that energy, all the powers of the Aleph Beis, and he put it in. As a matter of fact, he changed the script the way we know it today. And the way we look at an Aleph Beis Gimel Dalet is not the same that it was written originally in the time of Ezra, or before Ezra. And one of the reasons brought down that he did that was because we were no longer at a level to be able to absorb all the purity and the Kedusha, the holiness of the letters the way they were written. I have an example at home, maybe next time I'll bring it in, of a handscript that was written from the times of before Ezra. And the way the lettering looks, it looks very, very Arabic. And they don't look very much like the letters that we have today. So I'll bring in a sample that I have of an actual thing that was written in that language. And Chazal teaches that the reason he changed it was in order so that we can handle it. Because otherwise it was like putting too much electricity through a thin wire. It's going to burn out. If we try to read those letters today, if we try to do it without having the Kiddush or the level that they had in the Beis HaMikdash, we wouldn't have been able to make it. So Ezra had to change the letters to tame them down a little bit, so to speak, so that it would be palatable and usable by us as well. After Ezra died, the position of the high priest was now passed down to Shimon HaTzadik. And if you look in Perkei Avos, it gives you a whole lineage of how it went from Shimon HaTzadik, Ezra, Shimon HaTzadik, and where it passed on afterwards. Shimon HaTzadik also assumed the position of the spiritual leader of the entire Jewish people. Now, this was a very, very big change in the way things were run up until that period of time. And the reason is, he set a precedent that was followed later on by the Chashmonaim, and centuries later it was followed the same precedent, that of concentrating both the spiritual and the temporal leadership into the hands of one individual. Shimon HaTzadik played both roles. He was the leader of the community as well as the Kohen Gadol. He played both roles all by himself. Now, for someone like Shimon HaTzadik, who was a pure individual, who was spiritually on an honest and fair level, he can handle that. His leadership was honest. It followed the path of Torah. Nobody questioned that when he executed a judgment that was fairly done. It was handled effectively and it was handled the way it needed to be handled. During Shimon HaTzadik's lifetime, the population and the economy of Judah became tremendously grown. At the time we say tremendously grown, we're talking about then, the population of all of Judah was about 350,000 people, of which in Eretz Yisrael, in Jerusalem, there were over, according to Josephus, who brings down, there were about 120,000 people, Jews, in Jerusalem at that period of time. So when I say it grew tremendously, it did, it prospered, but we're only looking at 350,000 people that we were able to calculate and talk about and deal with, of which 120,000 were in Jerusalem itself. Prosperity and a sense of well-being flourished throughout the small nation. It wasn't a big nation at the time. The country seemed secure. They were tranquil. They were under the benevolent loose control of the Persian Empire. Persia was okay with them. They didn't have much of a hard time. However, like in most cases, when you get comfortable and things look like they're going fine, that's not an indication of what's coming up and what's going to be happening. And unfortunately, what was about to happen was going to sweep the entire Mediterranean basin and Asia Minor, materially changing all of Jewish life and history as well. These changes came from the emerging power of Greece. Greece was now coming into power. For many centuries, Greece had remained almost self-destructive entity. They had these little city-states, little small areas that were all over the place, Thebes, Athens, Sparta. They had emerged from different Greek tribes and different groups, and for the most part, they were constantly fighting with one another, and they were constantly causing each other problems. They were never able to unite. Their early histories are all filled with blood, barbarism, inhumanity, and yet, at the same time, they also saw a tremendous amount of advances in culture that emerged from them at the same time. And technology and political thought was coming out of Greece at the same time that you had this barbarism and bloodbaths going on. Two totally diametrically opposed things taking place, coming out of the same culture, coming out of the same people. The Greeks were committed to the advancement of the arts, architecture, literature, effective government, drama, and of course, philosophy. They also established cities and colonies throughout the ancient world, spreading from Sicily to Syria, from Libya to the shores of the Black Sea. It's very interesting how one culture can somehow permit inhumanity and unspeakable barbarism, science and the arts, all to take place at the same time, from the same culture. It's like accepting the fact that there's no law, but yet being able to put out so much beauty and such nice things all at the same time. The way we identify with the Greek civilization, for the most part, is exactly that weird combination. We think of it as cruelty on one hand, and brilliance and beauty and creativity on the other. That's the way when we think about Greece, that's what we look back at today. That's the way we envision them. This ability to blend these two polar opposites seems to have made itself into the 19th and 20th century, into certain cultures as well. And we see a repetition of what was going on. We're not going to talk about the 19th and 20th centuries today, but this mindset seems to be able to set itself up in such a way where societies can and are willing to deal with both of them at the same time. By the year 337, before the Common Era, these feuding city-states began to unite under the strong rule and leadership of Philip of Macedonia. By conquest, diplomacy, force of personality, Philip was successful in turning all these small little weak city-states into one strong national unity, one strong body, and a powerful military presence. That was what he was capable of doing on his own. And he became much, much more ambitious, and he wanted to do a lot more, and he wanted world dominion, like everybody always wants once they start getting powerful. Historic immortality is what he was looking for once he became more powerful. Unlimited wealth is what he wanted once he became more powerful. He wanted to overcome the Persian Empire and making Greece the center of the world. That was his goal. But, of course, Hashem has his way. And before he can realize any of these dreams, in the year 336 before the Common Era, he was assassinated. So he didn't get very far with these dreams and these ambitions, but he did manage to unite all the small little city-states and pull them together, unified under one umbrella as one people. Philip left a son, an heir, and this person is going to be remembered throughout history as probably the most formidable hero and conquerors of the ancient world. And of course, most of you know this young man was named Alexander. And he was known later on as Alexander the Great. We need to mention here for a moment that we're once again torn between two versions of time as it dates and relates to the ancient world. And when I say that, I mean the following. Most general history books of today's time and day date Philip's death and Alexander's ascension to the throne, as I've just mentioned it here. According to this dating, Alexander was born in the year 355 BCE and died in 323 BCE at the age of 32. Since he visited Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, 1 or 2 years before his death, that would put him in Jerusalem in the year 325 to 324 before the Common Era. Most traditional history books date his arrival in Jerusalem somewhat later and have a date of death somewhere between 318 and 313 BCE, which is about 10 to 15 year difference. So that if I occasionally mention something and you happen to know because you're a historian, or you remember reading somewhere and the dates seem to be a little off and incongruous, the reason is because there are differences in different volumes as to what the exact dates were when and where certain things took place. Gesundheit, you okay? Alexander became a myth, a larger-than-life figure. Legend, and this is based on the Greek legends, have him combining superhuman strength and courage with supernatural powers, and a warrior who experienced, and this is very interesting and important, precise, accurate omens. And we'll see what that means in a minute. That was part of what he was receiving. Greek legend credits him with making the sea recede. Okay, you know what? It seems that every time somebody wants to take a position of power in the world, they have to have something to do with the water splitting or receding. You know, Moshe Rabbeinu had it, and then now we have to discuss that as part of, you know, we know somebody else who walked on water, and now we have to describe, you know, for Alexander that he was able to make the sea recede for some reason. There seems to be something about that being a formal, strong position that he was able to do that, but that's one of the things attributed to Alexander, that he actually made the sea recede. Whether that was a euphemism because he took over more land and they needed more land, I don't know, but that's one of the things he's accredited with. Another thing that he did, they say that he was able to tame animals just by staring at them. That's also something that we give power to the Baal Shem Tov for, and things of that sort. But they say Alexander the Great had that fierce, had that look in his eye, that fire, that if an animal would come at him, he would just stare him down, and he would be able to tame an animal just with his gaze, just with his look. And the most important part is that he was always able to anticipate the plans of his enemies. Somehow, whenever he went into battle or whatever was going on, he was able to predict and know what's going on with his oncoming enemies. And that's one of the things that people were amazed about, his fighting abilities. The Gemara in Yuma tells us, and the Talmud says that, and the Gemara in Tamid also says the same thing, that Alexander's remarks to Shimon HaTzadik, because they met, and we'll see in a minute where and when, they said that Shimon HaTzadik appeared to him before every battle, and he said, and he predicted his wins. Shimon HaTzadik would come to Alexander in a dream, and he would say, this battle you're going to win, go for it. Hold off, don't fight. Go into this one. This is something that Alexander said later, we'll see momentarily. The great philosopher Aristotle was Alexander's mentor and tutor when he was very, very young. And as he grew older, Aristotle stayed along with him. He remained on as his private teacher and as an advisor to Alexander as he went through his growth and as he kept taking over and conquering more and more lands. Although Alexander had tremendous intellectual curiosity and scholarly interests, the most thing that he liked more than anything else, his goal in life, was to conquer, was to fight, and to be able to constantly be involved in military battle, one or another. That's what he lived for, that's what he wanted to do, and that's what ultimately he was known for. But, like any great conqueror, he was an alcoholic, he was a womanizer, and he had violent mood swings. This is part of what Alexander was about. He was capable of enormous kindness, and at the same time, unbelievable sadism. All this led to an early death at the age of 32, as we mentioned earlier. It was because of his lifestyle, not because he was killed in battle, that he brought himself down. And yet, with all of his issues, his Jekyll and Hyde type personality swings, he was still referred to as the Great. What's interesting is that in any of the Jewish liturgy about Alexander, the terminology the Great is never, ever used. They always call him just Alexander the Macedonian. He's never referred to as the Great. Why? I once had a Rebbe in the yeshiva, one of my principals, once said that by the non-Jewish world, you know, why do we consider a hero? We look at a Moshe Rabbeinu, we look at a, you know, Avraham Avinu, people who sacrificed Yitzchak on the Akedah. That's, we look up to as heroes. My Rebbe once said, what does the non-Jewish world look at a hero? He goes, I'll tell you how you can figure it out. If you take a sandwich, and you make a piece of bread longer than 12 people can possibly eat, and you stuff it with more meat and more salads and more things than anybody else can possibly eat, and you stoop yourself with it for about an hour and a half, that's a hero sandwich. He goes, that's what you call a hero. Something with longer stuff. To them, that's what a hero is. So, you know, Alexander the Great, if you look at the things he did that Greek represented and Greek enjoyed, you can say, yeah, that was Alexander the Great. But he was a great warrior and he was a great fighter, but we never refer to him as the Great, just as Alexander the Macedonian. In the year 333, before the Common Era, Alexander's army crossed into Asia Minor, and they went to a place called Phrygia. I think that's the way it's pronounced. Sometimes it's hard for me to know the pronunciation. When I read something, I don't always know how it's said, but I try to get it correct. He cut through the knot that bound the yoke. Anybody ever heard of a Gordian's knot, the Gordian knot? So this is the knot that tied Gordian's chariot to the yoke. And the rumor was, and the oracle stated, that anybody who can open up the knot would be the conqueror of Asia. And there's different versions as to what exactly Alexander did. Some people think he just used a new approach and he unhooked it first from the yoke, and then he worked the knot backwards from the inside out, found the two ends and undid the knot. Others say that he just took his sword and sliced right through the middle of it, found the two ends and opened up the knot accordingly. But the bottom line is that he created and found a way of moving around and doing something different than the norm, and therefore he was able to open up and cut through the Gordian knot. Thus, having solved the Gordian knot, he fulfilled the oracle's prediction, and he actually felt that now it was his right and ability to go on to conquer and to conquer Asia. Alexander defeated Darius and the Persian army. Darius escaped the first time around. Alexander turned south to Phoenicia to control Syria, Judah, and Egypt. That's the direction he took. In 331 before the Common Era, Alexander once again met and defeated Darius and the Persian army at Guagamela, I believe that's the proper pronunciation, and he now ruled over the entire Persian Empire as well. He started new campaigns in Afghanistan, the Hindu Kush, and Punjab of India. He wanted everything. He wasn't happy with anything. At this stage, his troops were exhausted, they were tired, and they were rebelling, they mutinied, they left him to be, and because of that, he returned to Babylonia, where he died suddenly in Babylon. That's where he ended up dying. During his conquest of the Persian Empire, Alexander, as I mentioned earlier, came to Jerusalem about a year, a little bit more than a year, before he died. If you remember from the last Shir class that we had, the Samaritans, the Kutim, they were called the Samaritans, they were the local residents when the building of the Beis HaMikdash began. They asked to be participants to participate. They were not allowed to do that. And they went out of their way to disrupt the building of the Beis HaMikdash. And they tried to persuade Cyrus, who at the time had given permission for it to be built, to remove his authorization of the building of the temple. Construction at that point came to a halt on Cyrus's decree, and the Kutim actually and actively sought to have that ban continued to never allow it to be built. Once again, as we know, it did start the building all over again, and after the second Beis HaMikdash was completed in the year 349 BCE, and Ezra and Nehemiah had rehung the gates to the city, which we spoke about last time, in the year 335 BCE, the Kutim continued their antagonism and were excommunicated by the Anshe Knesset HaGdolah, by the men of the Great Assembly, who excommunicated the Kutim because of their constant attempts to try and shut down and stop the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, they had received, the same Kutim had received permission from Alexander to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. So, by describing it as a symbol of rebellion against the empire, that's the way they told Alexander that the Beis HaMikdash was. It's a symbol of rebellion. That's what the Jews are doing. They're creating their own. Everything around you, they don't need you. They are rebelling. So Alexander said, go for it. No problem. Give you permission. Take it down. Alexander himself was going to the Beis HaMikdash to see what was going on. And Shimon HaTzadik was selected to be the person to go down and to seek relief from Alexander, to plead with him, to talk to him about allowing the Beis HaMikdash to exist. The Gemara in Yuma tells us that on the 25th day of Teves, when Shimon HaTzadik put on all the priestly garbs of the Kohen Gadol, he got himself totally dressed up, he stepped out of the Beis HaMikdash, he approached Alexander's entourage when they came in to see him, and as he went out to greet Alexander, Alexander saw him, Alexander jumped off his horse and bowed down to Shimon HaTzadik. All of his generals, all of his soldiers, they were at a loss. They were angry. It's like, what does he think he's doing? What is this? And Alexander explained to them, as I mentioned to you in the very beginning, that the many, many times when he went into battle, when he saw a vision of somebody telling him, go forth and you'll conquer, this was the man. This man that he's looking at, this is the person who came to me in my dream all these years, and I was victorious all these times because of him. After visiting the Beis HaMikdash, and after seeing the avoda that was being done there, Alexander withdrew his support from the Kutim. He no longer allowed them to do anything to the Beis HaMikdash. He said that subsequently, go ahead and build, not a problem, you can continue going. And the Kutim went ahead and they built their own temple on Har Gerizim, the Mount Gerizim, and they did their own thing. They brought sacrifices there. They left and they just went off to do their own thing at that point. Similarly to today, when everybody wants a piece of Israel when it's there, the Canaanites, the Ishmaelites, those tribes made representations to Alexander that claiming the territory of Eretz Israel belonged to them. Then they sent out, it was a hunchback in the Jewish community, his name was Gevia. And they sent him out, and he successfully argued the case in front of Alexander. And on the 24th of Nisan, he won the case, and the Jews were safe in the Beis HaMikdash, not having to worry about it for any period of time with Alexander's blessing. Alexander, wherever he traveled, wherever he went, spread his Greek culture. And that's why they ended up in the Beis HaMikdash itself using Roman numerals, Greek letters, to mark certain things, items, and that to store it, file it. They actually used Greek lettering in the Beis HaMikdash instead of the Olive Beis to do that because that's part of what they got from Alexander's coming through. One of the things he asked for was, fine, I'm letting the Beis HaMikdash exist, but I want you to build a statue of me in the Beis HaMikdash itself. He still had his ego, he still had his pride, and he says, I'm letting it exist, but I want a statue of me to exist in the Beis HaMikdash. And Shimon HaTzadik got to explain to him how this would be very disagreeable with the Jewish religious feelings, and it would be problematic, but instead, he offered Alexander something that he said would be much more honorable to him, and show how much the Jewish people really enjoyed and appreciated him, And he said that for the next year, every male child that would be born would be named Alexander. There are some versions that say only the Kohanim, every male Kohen that was born, but it seems to be from what I've researched and looked up that every male child, and of course that's where we get the names from today, Sender, Alex, that's all come from that period of time when they were all named Alexander, which was a Greek name, not a Jewish name. They also pledged allegiance to Alexander, and they agreed to pay tribute and taxes to his coffers that they can come pick up, and they would pay him peace. They wanted peace. Well, keep our base on Mikdash. We'll work with you. We'll give you the honor you deserve, but just let us be. And everybody was happy with that situation. Everybody worked out just fine. They also accepted something else upon themselves. The year that Alexander conquered the empire, there's a halacha that if you look in the Gemara Rosh Hashanah, it says that we mark the years based on the kings. In other words, if you write a document, Reuven borrowed money from Shimon on the second month, the second day of the second month, in the first year of the ruling of Alexander. When you said year one, year two, year three, well, how do we have those to compare it to? We're now in the year 2015, but that's 2015 of the common era, based on supposedly when there was a new birth, a rebirth, and, you know, Yeshua came into existence. That's what we're counting 2,000 years from. In those days, when they made documents, they marked year two, year three, but of what? Of the ruling of the king. So they gave Alexander the honor that the beginning of the count of the year would be based on his conquest and what he had done. So that went on for several hundred years, 1,500 to 1,800 years, they were actually using. So when they saw a document that said 1,300, in the year 1,300, it meant in the year 1,300 from the time of Alexander. So that was a very, very big honor that they gave to him. And the Gemara discusses how that's a Rosh Hashanah for kings, what day of the year Rosh Hashanah for kings comes out on. Like many, many people, Alexander never believed that he can die, probably never believed that he would die, and therefore no realistic line of succession was established during his lifetime. And when his unexpected death came to being, there was internal fighting between his kin, between his generals, and a struggling to power, and who's going to take over, who the succession is going to go to. No one person had the ability, the power, the personality, the talent to represent, to replace Alexander and take over and run the entire Greek Empire single-handedly. So the empire broke into various factions. By the year 290 before the Common Era, three major kingdoms had developed from after Alexander passed away. Each headed by one of Alexander's generals. These kingdoms would rule the Mediterranean world until their own eventual fall to Rome. When Rome came in and conquered, they all three fell. But in the meantime, between them and Rome, these three kingdoms existed. The nucleus of Alexander's empire, Greece and Macedonia, itself was controlled by Antigonus Gonatas. Again, forgive me if my pronunciations are wrong. Egypt and Libya, as well as some of the Greek islands and colonies in Asia Minor, became the kingdom of Talmai Sotar. Assyria, Babylonia, and parts of Turkey were ruled by Seleucus. In the year 312 BCE, Seleucus and Talmai combined to defeat Antigonus and his son Demetrius in battle near the Gaza in Judah, thereby preventing their attempt from sole control of Alexander's entire empire. Seleucus proceeded north to the capital of Babylonia and established the Seleucus kingdom. Talmai went south to solidify his hold over Egypt, and he concentrated his government in a great new area called Alexandria, named for its conqueror, Alexander the Great. Although over the next 20 years, these three dynasties were well established, got along well in theory, there was always war between them, there was always trying fights to dominate, and ultimately they did not get along with one another peacefully, even though each one had its own section, everybody always wanted more. Now the Commonwealth of Judah laid squarely between the Ptolemaic Kingdom of Egypt, which was on the south side, and to the north was the Seleucid Kingdom of Syria. And the landmass of Eretz Yisrael, which was between the two, was the commercial and strategic bridge that connected Asia Minor with Africa. And this was therefore of vital importance both for a for both kingdoms from a military perspective and from a business perspective. And they were constantly fighting over that piece of land, which was Eretz Yisrael. That was the strategic spot that they needed for crossover. Economic advantages would be taking place if you ruled and owned that area. You had tremendous economic advantages. You had military advantages. The competition between the Talmud and the Sassanid forces for supremacy would center over who was that ruled Jerusalem and Judah. That was ultimately, you were in charge, you had the best hand up. If you can control Jerusalem, if you control Judah, you were on the top, you were the winning hand. So for the next 150 years, until about the year 165, before the Common Era, the struggle for dominance ravaged the entire Jewish state with increasingly detrimental results, because they were constantly in the middle of everybody fighting over everything they had. How long can you live? How well can you live when there's constantly battles going on around you, everybody trying to conquer and take over your land? The Talmais and the Sadducees were each established their own Jewish groups. Each one got their own people to follow them in Judah, and each one allied themselves, groups of Jews allied themselves with the different powers, trying to get close to them so they would be on their good side when they're in power. And each one followed the cultures of their imperial sponsors, because it made sense. It's like, it's kind of like those going with the Democrats and those going with the Republicans. You stick with your party, and hopefully when they're in power, you're going to be in a better position, you're going to be in a better place. The Jewish Commonwealth from the time of Alexander's death until the successful revolt of the Hashmonaim in the year 165 BCE was essentially alternating its loyalties between the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid masters, kept going back and forth. There were many, many disputes and even civil wars between the competing Jewish groups. It was the Jewish groups that had civil wars with each other, and they were just interested in proving their devotion to their Jewish sponsors. I wanted to prove to you that I'm really on your side, so when you're in charge, you'll take care of me. And they would constantly start wars and fights amongst each other. Their alliances were not Jew for Jew, but it was Jew against Jew, supporting their financial sponsors, territorial sponsors, etc. Shimon HaTzadik had now served as Kohen Gadol for 40 years, and as the head of the Sanhedrin as well. His son Shimi became the Kohen Gadol after him, and he had a second son named Chonyo II. His father's name was also Chonyo, so he was Chonyo II. And he left for Egypt after a jealousy dispute with his brother. The Gemara in Menachos tells us that Chonyo II went so far as to build an altar for sacrifices in Egypt. Antigonus Ishsocho, which is brought down in the Pirkei Avos as well, succeeded Shimon HaTzadik as the head of the Great Assembly. So when Shimon HaTzadik passed away, Antigonus Ishsocho took over his role. However, after Shimon HaTzadik died in the year 273 BCE, the control over the affairs of the Jewish people and the men of the Great Assembly, remember I told you he had handled both temporal and spiritual? That can no longer be handled by any one individual. That also now split up into two different groups. There were two parallel forms of Jewish government that were taking place, which came up in Judah. The first was the provisional government, which was led by the Jews whose loyalty and the goals were controlled by the Talmudic governments, by the Seleucids. And again, the Jews went and followed them accordingly. And then they enforced governmental decrees, collected the taxes for them, etc., etc. The other side was you had the spiritual government, the spiritual head of the Sanhedrin, which was also, they had no policing power, they had no taxing power, they had no way of enforcing anything, but they taught through education, religious behavior, example, and now we had two different factions, even spiritually and monetarily, split up in the government itself. This way of life continued throughout the period of the Second Temple, and only for short periods of times were the people themselves, the Jews, unified under this, under any type of leadership, that they were together during the Second Temple period. The Ptolemaic Empire was dominant in Judah for most of the century, following Alexander's death in the year 323 BCE. Talmai the First, or Talmai Soter, as I referred to him earlier, was a very, very harsh taskmaster over Judah. He exiled over 100,000 Jews to Egypt, especially to Alexandria, where initially most of them were treated as slaves. Eventually, under the rule of Talmai II, who was a much, much gentler and kinder than his father was, these Jews were able to ransom themselves, to gain freedom for themselves, and they soon became famous for their skills, because they were very, very talented and very, very capable, but not at first given the opportunity to show their talents and their capabilities. Now they started working as goldsmiths, as silversmiths, leather, ceramics, artistry, weavers, dyers, traders, merchants. All of a sudden, what they had to offer society was being allowed to come forth and being allowed to show, because it was much easier on them and they were no longer there operating as slaves. Talmai I had drafted many, many Jews into his army and stationed them in all the vast areas of his empire. He spread them out all over the place, and many of those Jews, even when their army time had ended, remained there. And that's the beginning and what started part of the Jewish exile outside of the area of Jerusalem, Egypt, because they were spread. They finished their army service. They just remained where they were. Under the rule of Talmai II, which was the son of the first, many Jews became wealthy. They profited from the transit trade between Alexandria and Damascus, and their agriculture produce was in great demand in the Ptolemaic Egypt, so they were doing very, very well in business. Jews became tax and customs collectors for Talmai. Tax brokers kept a percentage of what they collected. So the problem with that obviously is that the more tax you collect, the more money you make, because it was a commission job, which gave them the incentive and the desire to try and push taxes up and up and up, because it was benefiting their own pockets. Even though it was your own brothers you were collecting from, the bottom line is that's what they did because it was financially worth it for them to do so. Unfortunately, Jews became synonymous with collection. People understood them as money dealers, as tax collectors. One of the more famous families in the tax collection business was called Yosef ben Tovia. That was the family. They were known as the Bnei Tovia. The Bnei Tovia, which is a term which became a very derogatory term, like saying a nasty thing about the Jews, they would say, oh, they're probably the Bnei Tovia. It was like a very, very derogatory term because they did not treat people well when they went, like I mentioned, they were making money on it, and they just let it build up, and they kept going with it. The overall prosperity in Judah led to the formation of an upper class whose loyalties laid with their Greek masters, like I mentioned earlier, and not with their Jewish brethren, unfortunately. As always, when this happens, it leads to fights, great strain and violence within the Jewish community. The families of the high priests especially were enriched themselves through the service to the Talmais. People would buy their position of Kohen Gadol. And they didn't even acknowledge and recognize the fact that when they would go into the Beis HaMikdash and Yom Kippur, and they would go do the high service, no Kohen Gadol ever stepped out alive from the Holy of Holies. Because it wasn't an earned position, it wasn't a spiritual position they had achieved. They had bought it from the king. They bought their right to become Kohen Gadol. This caused a tremendous, tremendous resentment amongst the regular Kohanim, amongst the people of the Jewish people who were not bought into and not from the upper class. And needless to say, it caused problems. The ordinary priests, as well as much of the masses of Israel, the great Torah scholars, were repelled by the corruption of the Kohen Gadol, of the high priest and his families. The corruption would eventually lead to the upper class becoming more Greek than Jewish, more pagan than godly. They liked the money. That's where they chose to stay. Talmai II reigned from the year 285 to 246 BCE. He was a man of peace and culture. Rather than seeking war and expansion, he built libraries, schools. Talmai II was interested in all types of literature. He was therefore determined to translate into the Hebrew Bible into Greek. That's one of the things he wanted to achieve. This had been attempted earlier by Talmai I. With five people, he was unsuccessful at making that happen. The Gemara tells us that Talmai II invited 72 scholars, and he asked them each to translate the Bible into, and this was called, I think the terminology they say is the translation of the 70, it's known as the Septuagint. That one I got right. Septuagint, that's the way, but Septuagint really means of the 70, there were 72, according to the Gemara, not 70, so I guess the name would have been too long, Septuagint. I don't know what so they left it to Septuagint. The Gemara tells us that on the eighth day of Teves, These 72 translators produced a synchronized translation, including identical changes in 13 different places of the Torah. And the Gemara itemizes what the 13 changes were, that each one of them in a separate private room, unbeknownst to them what the other was doing, made the exact same changes. And they changed them as a simplistic terminologies. I'm not going to go through 13. I'll just give you an example. The very, very first pasuk of the Torah says, Bereshis bara Elokim. If you read that literally, if you translate it, it says, Bereshis created Elokim. That implies that there's more than one God. Something created God. Any place there was that type of a question, they automatically changed and translated it to mean in the beginning of creation of time by Elokim. They all did the exact same changes. So, you know, one would stop and think and say, wow, this was obviously the hand of God. It was divinely inspired. Baruch Hashem, 72 people. Put three people in a room, three Jews in a room, and try and get them to say the same thing. Reading it from a piece of paper, it doesn't happen. 72 people coming from different rooms, all the exact same translation. So obviously it was the hand of God, but still you should know that the rabbis generally disapproved of the project. And on the eighth day of Teves, when the project was completed, they marked on the calendar the 8th of Teves as a day of darkness. Now, why would you think that that would be so, a day of darkness versus a day of miracle? I would think, you know, throw a party, give Kiddush and Shul, right? Unbelievable. Well, their take on it was like this. It's a two-sided sword. Not only did it make available to teach Torah to the non-Jewish community, which we don't necessarily have a strong need or desire to have happen. Torah was given to us, for us to learn from, for us to know, for us to utilize. Okay, so it became available to the non-Jewish world, but the other side was that it also taught the Jews Greek. And when the Jews saw that their, you know, the same thing happened when the Jews agreed to Alexander, named their children Alexander for a year, it seemed like it was a very innocent choice, but Jews used that, all of a sudden, all the Greek names started filling into Klal Yisrael. And they said, once the doors are open, then I can use a Greek name. Well, I happen to like the name so-and-so, and I like Josephus, and I like... And instead of just naming children Alexander, they started bringing in and introducing more and more of the Greek culture by allowing the names to come in. That's an opening. Once you open the door, once you crack the egg, whatever's there can flow through right now. So it starts with a name, and then it goes into a culture, and then it goes into a belief, and it keeps spreading. So the rabbis were really very upset, because now all of a sudden the Jews were speaking Greek. They were naming their children Greek names. And they were saying, that if the Torah scholars went ahead and translated it, then obviously it's okay for us to translate it, for us too. And things always get lost in the translation. And it caused more problems than it did advantages. And that's why it was named the Day of Darkness. Okay, this ended the tremendous intellectual and social force of Hellenism. What is Hellenism? I'm going to give you a quick 2-second introduction as to what Hellenism is based on how it applies to the Greek times, and then we'll stop and we'll continue next time with that. It was a new view of man. Even though the Greeks were pagans, they were professing a belief in many, many different gods, fearsome of many petty gods. It didn't make a difference. They toyed with the lives and the futures of humans, the gods. In reality, the Greeks were human-centered. They were very, very much self-centered. They lived with the inner sense that somehow man was the all-powerful and that the gods are basically disinterested in human behavior. The gods were there only to be bribed, to be fooled, and any really clever human really didn't have to come on to the gods whatsoever. He can live his life very, very well without them. Moreover, many of the Greeks, such as Aristotle, even Alexander himself, no longer even believed in the gods. They didn't believe the fantastic stories they heard about the gods. They didn't believe in their existence anymore. Their worship was seen only as a unifying national force, a means by which to keep everybody together to discuss. They didn't even believe that Zeus existed. It was just a matter of keeping everyone together and united under one name. So that's what kept the people close. But Alexander himself didn't believe at the end that Zeus was actually a god. Aristotle believed in an imperfect monotheism in which the universe whose creator really didn't care. He created, there was one God, but he didn't care about what went on earth. He didn't care about the sun. He created and he stepped aside and said, you guys are all on your own. Therefore, even if the belief in the supremacy of the gods and their actual existence had begun to wane amongst the Greek intelligentsia. At the same time, the service, the sacrifices, the temples, the priests, the paganism, that always kept going, because that was the unifying factor amongst the people. The post-pagan view of the centrality of man led to an explosion in the public exhibition of human talents, and this meant developing a showcasing of talents. If it's all about man, then I have to show off my strengths, and I have to show off my abilities, and I have to create contests which can show my strengths and my abilities, because that's what it's all about. It's all about man. And therefore, the attractive to all non-Greeks in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE, in the modern era, the 19th to 20th centuries, were following the same mentality, the same ahalach, the same path. The centrality of man would again dominate human thought. It's about me, it's about fights, it's about wars, about arenas, about being able to defeat, the stronger the better. That's the mentality, that's what it was about. The Greeks valued literature, drama, poetry, the works of the great poets such as Homer, I'm not even going to try and pronounce half of the names that I wrote down here, who they were, and the others are still valued by Western culture today. Aristophanes, Menander remain the fathers of modern drama in tragedy and in comedy. And this is where we're going to stop tonight at this point in the growth, and we're going to pick up from here with how this changed from here to the Hashmonaim, where it went bad to the Jewish people, how they lost the destruction of the temple again, story of Hanukkah, and pick up after this and keep going forward. Have a good night.